Hello, this is Melissa, and I am with Darren, and today we're having another try at talking about Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope. And what we said that we were going to do was start with Russia. There's that big section at the last part of the reading assignment, which is the Russian Empire to 1917. And what we both realized separately in reading this is that we got all the way through and thought, well, there's a lot of key stuff in this section, and the things at the beginning of the book don't make as much sense until you cover this thoroughly. And so I was just telling Darren just now before we hit the record button that from the very beginning of getting into this book, I found that I was at odds with Carol Quigley's characterization of the differences between Christianity as it developed in Western civilization and the Russian civilization, what he calls Orthodox civilization. And I wanted to just take a stab at putting my thinking across, because like we both conveyed in the first recording that we did, this is an important book. It's important to understand the thinking behind the book and who was the audience for it and is the audience for this kind of writing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everything that Quigley writes about is the truth and the whole truth. It definitely has a spin. There was something that Darren said in our first recording that got me thinking, and that was when he was talking about what this oligarchy has done to us in the last 4 years during Operation COVID. And Darren said, if you think that they have done this for greed, then you should just get up and out the room. Go and watch television, because this is not about money for them. And then, Darren, you went on to elaborate that you believed that they were creating their perfect new world for them, their perfect environment with the right kind of worker. And that is definitely ties into conclusions that Alan Watt made. But I just wanted to read a little section from Alan's Cutting Through book, Volume 1. I have mentioned this page 5 several times because I find it quite illuminating. And when I reread the books for the first time after Alan passed away, when I got to this place, I was gobsmacked, as Alan would say, because I realized that Alan had come out in the 90s with this information with a particular point of view about where we were and where we were headed, which looked pretty bleak. And yet he did it anyway. And I realized then that he did it for the individual who could think their way through this. And to me, that was just an amazing thing. But I'll get right to it, because again, it ties in with what Darren said last week. At the top of page 5, Alan wrote, "This is not a rehearsal. This is the final phase of humanity as we know it." Sound shocking? Then go back to your Levi Zion, your television, and continue your programming. Your faith in the system creates your fate. Those who have no aversion to thinking, persevere, and you will be rewarded. By symbols, said Thomas Carlyle in Sartor Resartus, is man guided and commanded, made happy, made wretched. He everywhere finds himself surrounded with symbols, recognized as such, or not recognized. An age, in astronomical terms, lasts for 2,160 years. This is called the Great Reset, This is called the Great or Platonic Year, after Plato, the Greek aristocrat who lived over 2,300 years ago. Now, how come he knew how long the great precession took? Science is based on observation and repetition. If it had been observed before, then the charting of the heavens would have to have begun over 4,600 years ago. At the beginning of that age, it means there was a leisure class of learned people dedicated to heavenly observation. For them to have such a system means the previous age had a form of government capable of forcing the peasants to feed this leisure class. Now, I'm going to skip just a little bit, but what he is writing about here is an elite down through time who understand technique. And as Alan goes on to write, this technique of imprisoning the mind was well understood from antiquity. Up into the Industrial Revolution, when only an elite comprised of nobility, priests, and the officers of the military had education, control was fairly simple. The body was threatened with physical death, and the spirit with eternal damnation. Now, I'm going to, before I get in back to Tragedy and Hope, I'm going to skip over to page 11 in Cutting Through. Again, and this is a section called History and Religion. And he writes, history is the systemic telling of false stories. So what are we studying now with Quigley's Tragedy and Hope? It's a history book. History is the systemic telling of false stories about a series of apparently unrelated events that occurred in the past, in order to create an erroneous public opinion about who, what, where, when, why, and how certain events took place. And he then goes on to write about how old humankind is in its present form, how they would have had to have studied these techniques for so long. He said, due to new evidence that is just now emerging about complex secret codes that are currently being deciphered, these having been found embedded within the text of the Hebrew Torah, better known to Christians as the Old Testament, codes that leave no doubt that advanced computation and other technologies were available to a limited number of male priests thousands of years ago, long before the marketing of organized religion. Now, this is a kind of a key point here, this next sentence. Popular acceptance of everlasting life, okay? Popular acceptance. Many eons ago, people accepted everlasting life. This was hijacked by the priests and used as a weapon of war. Their Book of the Dead served as the first Bible, Quran, Talmud, etc. Religion, as opposed to spirituality, politics in lieu of freedom, appear to have been created by these militant priests to mislead humankind into giving them absolute power over the world, power that rightfully belongs only to the creator of the universe. So finally, because we're not going to spend that much time in Alan's books, but finally, I want you to know that the third volume of his Cutting Through series is called Esoteric Unveiled and the Meaning of Revelations in the High Masonic Tradition. And in this volume, he gets quite a bit into astrology and ages. And why this came into my head in a strong way this morning is because Great Reset, what do they believe? How are the elite guided? And there is some division about when the age of Aquarius begins. Is it now? Was it 50 years ago? Is it 100 years from now? But one thing that I'm trying to put across here is that the precession of ages matters a great deal to this ancient brotherhood down through time. We think of the age of Jesus was the age of Pisces, and it is no coincidence that sometimes Christianity is represented by the symbol of the fish. And Jesus talked about being a fisher of men. And here, right here from the Bible in Luke, Jesus said, a man will meet you carrying an earthen pitcher of water. Follow him into the house where he goes in. What is the pitcher of water? The age of Aquarius. So all through the Bible is astrology and ages. And I do believe that if we talk about the rise and fall of civilizations, we are sometimes talking about these zodiacal ages that this ancient priesthood have studied. Now, I know this might sound just kind of crazy wild to some people, but getting into what Quigley writes about Christianity, first of all, it's incredibly simplistic. And I think in some ways, it's just flat out wrong. And when he makes an arbitrary division between the Western way of thinking being material, being rational, and Christianity is a certain way, when he writes about Christianity, that is something that I don't even recognize. He calls Western civilizations Christianity this worldly. And then he calls the Orthodox or Russian civilization's version of Christianity otherworldly and irrational. And I think it's important, Russian or Orthodox civilization comes from Byzantium or the Byzantine Empire. And I think it's important that we say that people who were living under the Byzantine Empire did not call it such. They were Eastern Roman Empire, coexisting at the same time as the Western Roman Empire. And Constantine comes from the lineage of the Byzantine Empire. Constantine, who we say is the political father of Christianity, if you will. This is from the Orthodox line or lineage of political leadership. And it was under Constantine that we had the Council of Nicaea, where all of these church leaders got together and hashed out what was to be a heresy and what was to be considered orthodox or accepted thinking about Christianity. And Quigley positions this in terms of a dualistic way of thinking that Christianity came into, and Christianity as having a Semitic, this-worldly heritage. And was Paul a Semite? Yes. Was Jesus a Semite? Yes. I'm giving a nod to their historiosity, that there was a Jesus who lived in time, and he was a Semite. But the first version, the first popular version of the Old Testament was Greek, the Septuagint. The New Testament was done in Greek. So here we have moved over into the Western world, into exactly that dualistic thinking that Quigley is talking about. And I'm just going to say, for the sake of argument, that however long this ancient priesthood is, and however much they have captured all of the religions, I'm just going to say, for the sake of argument, there was a historical Jesus. And somehow the people who were close to him understood the deeper meanings of what he was saying. At the very, very heart of it is exactly what Alan was writing about in the Cutting Through books. Truth has been hijacked by people who do not want you to know about everlasting or eternal life. It has been made into a this worldly. What did Jesus always said? This world is not my home. The foxes have a den and the birds have their nest, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. That is not a this worldly religion. So what I'm saying, what I believe to be the truth of the inception of Christianity and how it might have separated into two different kinds of practice with Orthodox, Greek Orthodox and or Russian Orthodox, and you know, it's known by different names, and what we call Catholicism or Roman Christianity and its offshoots of Protestantism as a protest against that. What I'm saying is that in there seems to have been the kernel of a truth that people actually lived out in that time, meaning they were willing to go into a Colosseum and be mauled to death by lions. Who would do that for a this worldly belief? So that's what I'm saying, that Quigley has made a very oversimplified and I think deliberately misleading assessment of what is Christianity. Because I do think that these two things are going to factor in a lot, but not necessarily in the way that Quigley says they are. This tension is still on the go because you've got Our Lady of Fatima and these visions that these Portuguese or Spanish children, I think they were from Portugal, but these children had this vision in the 1930s and the lady said, and then, you know, it tied into predictions about World War II and so forth and so on. But a key thing there was the consecration of Russia, which actually did finally just happen. I think it's happened a few times, but most recently in 2022 with the invasion of the Ukraine, when the current Pope consecrated Russia. This is to usher in an age of peace, et cetera, et cetera. So this tension of what is Christianity and how and what is being played out in front of us, I think, is important. But I'm going to go back. I'm going to bring it into the present, because Alan spent a lot of time in his talks in 2006 and 2007 telling us what the elite believed. And essentially, to boil it down into the little bitty tiny bit here, it's that they are the fallen angels, but they would call themselves gods of this world. And how do they get back to the incredible stature, the incredible powers that they had before their fall? Well, they do it with inbreeding. They do it with eugenics programs. They do it by trying to dominate us and any ability that we might have to fight them on a spiritual plane, by assuring that we are strictly materialist, that we are strictly rational, that we are never able to see what may be, because that has been either bred out of us, tampered out of us through toxins and getting into our brain and tweaking here and there, or by simply saying it's not true, and if you think otherwise, well, you're kind of silly, aren't you? So Alan was repeatedly pointing out what they themselves believed and how they have put that across in their writing. And it ties back in again, Darren, with what you said, which is, I fear, you said, that they are turning us into robots. And that's exactly what Alan wrote. This is the end of humanity, the final phase of humanity as we know it. Now, I'm sorry that took me a lot longer to put that across. And let me stop talking, but I think that there's something here that is so profound to where we are, to true evil that we are living through, and it has been taken right out of our minds. And part of the problem is people like Quigley, who would have us believe that there's a rational way to see the world and an irrational way to see the world, and there's no middle ground.
Melissa, thanks very much for bringing that up. I think that the majority of the world consists of people of faith, and I think at some point religion had more of an inner meaning between family members before people went to church, whether it was pre-Christian or not. I think people had a much closer grounding to nature, but nature is the perfect reflection of God, and people were in that sense closer to God. And I think when the professional priests came along, they acted as a substitute for God, and in a sense they created a discombobulation in the minds of the believer. They sort of hijacked the natural spiritual default, the inner sense of what and who we are, our conscience, our true conscience. I think they hijacked that, and professional priests used that as a leverage against humanity. So for quite a long time now, people have had a part of themselves stolen from them and re-represented by a professional priesthood, which keeps on getting tampered with and changed depending on what particular form of government happens to be ruling, or over which group of people in particular that a ruling oligarchy wants to take control over. And then I just wanted to get back to you where you spoke about Pisces, something that that you can look up. In the early Christians, they, in the Greek, they've got a sacred anagram, which is it's known as the ichthys. I don't know if you've heard of the ichthys.
Mm-hmm.
In Greek, it spells out, the translation is, where is it? Jesus Christ, God's Son, Savior. But when you put those Greek letters together, it means fish. So the people that had created this religion already knew about the zodiac. They alluded to it. And what I also found interesting, and I don't know if this has any meaning or not, it's just something that I remember, is that the ichthys is also represented by a wheel with 8 spokes in it. And right off the top of my head, it looks like a British flag in a circle. But what I found interesting, though, is that if you've got the time to look up Baha'i, and that's another discussion, but Baha'i is the new religion that's officially endorsed by the United Nations, and the Baha'i has 9 points to it.
Really?
Yeah, so who knows? Maybe the age before the Christian era had a 7 pointed item. I'm just speculating a little bit, but I just found it interesting.
That is interesting. And I don't know if you want to talk just a little bit about Baha'i, but also you have made some good points about the ways in which all of the agenda of Agenda 2030, sustainability, the Great Reset, and so forth, is being packaged within modern Christianity, because I think it's so easy for something to be hijacked right in front of people of faith.
That's taking advantage of people's faith. It bothers me particularly. If you go online and you take a look at some of the modern Christian denominations around various cities, the newer ones, you'll see that if you look at their founding, what's the word I'm looking for, Melissa, the founding creed of that particular denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them have what you would, it looks like they've copied and pasted it straight from the United Nations Earth Charter and also the various organizations within the UN. They've borrowed from all of those various satellite organizations with regards to city planning, you know, and the, a lot of what the World Economic Forum is going on about, smart cities. And then they've also adapted to and they've incorporated all the trendy talking points as well, such as climate change, global warming, all of that. And it's snuck itself into a lot of different religions, not just Christianity. And I do speak to my neighbors. I've spoken to a number of Christians who've told me, look, they feel a bit alienated from their church, and they've had to seek and look for more authentic spiritual leaders or churches around town. They've just noticed that there's definitely an agenda to what is being preached through the various religions. It no longer feels like Christianity and the following of a higher purpose for its own purpose, just for the sake of itself. Now there has to be an agenda attached to it, and there's a new form of morality that's coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And what you'll notice with the multi-faith organizations that Ted Turner and many of these big boys are involved with and starting is that if you look closely at the New Age, you'll see how even Islam and Buddhism have been infused with the New Age, and it's all paths now are gently and consistently edging toward the new secular religion of Baha'i.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what kind of time frame they're looking at, maybe over the next 100 years, but you can see how they're diluting all the faiths that exist. And I think it's quite clever because they're not opposing. They are not, you know, the more you oppose something, the more that a person will stick to it. So they're gently converting and changing all these faiths to a central point, Baha'i, and perhaps Baha'i will be renamed to something else for the next 2,000 years or so. Maybe Baha'i is just a transitional point where all the religions meet and then something new comes out of that. But take the time to look up Baha'i, and then once you've read up the foundational creed of Baha'i, switch across and immediately look at the first few pages of the UN Charter, and you'll think you're reading the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite stupendous how it's all being done right under our noses.
Mm-hmm. No, I have noticed that too. I mean, years ago I was more familiar with bits of Hinduism and bits of Buddhism, but in more recent years I have looked at the Sufi tradition, and unfortunately I've never had the opportunity to speak to someone who was practicing Sufism that was from a Muslim country that might have a different relationship to what that's about. But what is being put across in the West is completely New Age.
It's quite surprising what you miss. I try and look at other perspectives from around the world, but if you bury yourself into your search engine, you will start to see how the same thing is being applied everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
New Age Judaism, it exists. New Age Islam,
yes.
It exists.
Yes.
Even New Age Hinduism, it's all infiltrated in a sense. And mm-hmm. once you start getting to the first sort of links that you eventually find, it starts to give you additional searching areas, which you'll find very interesting, very interesting. What I also learned in India, for little things that they do, for example, to change the culture, Maybe somebody from India who has been to India can confirm it, but I read quite a strong article on how people in India have noticed that in their places of work, in the buildings, in the music that is played maybe in the mall or particularly in an elevator, it's Western 80s music, but there's no singing. There's no lyrics. It's just the music. So, you know, what will come to follow that will be probably lyrics. But you see how they are getting in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is centrally planned. The whole of India doesn't just suddenly start getting 80s, Western 80s pop music played without lyrics, you know. It doesn't just happen on its own. So if somebody else can confirm that for me, I'd appreciate that. But I read a fairly lengthy article on it, and it seems to be something that's true. But all these kind of things are meant to have an effect. We are surrounded by it in our own culture, and when I made the comment, I noticed a few people on the book club made a comment about the how the zeitgeist, most of it is fictitious, but it could even be worse. Not to drive you crazy or to think that nothing's real, but we'll be surprised how much we take for real when it's not. And I was just mm-hmm. thinking about people who were bluffed into believing that COVID-19 was a real thing. They had to sell people, you know what they call the big lie? The really mm-hmm. big lie is mm-hmm. that there is a plague. There is a novel virus,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to get you. And then everything else within it could be completely fictitious.
Mm-hmm.
But if you didn't see through the first lie, then you were caught in that framework. So you might have not trusted the media about how bad it was or who's being affected by it and all the detail. But in your mind, the reality is that there is a novel, deadly pathogen circulating the planet. So there is, and also within that frame is truth too. So a whole lot of truth is discussed and thrashed out, and you're allowed to talk about it left, right, and center till you're blue in the face, but you're operating within a greater lie.
Mm-hmm.
And people who have been awake for quite a long time, well, they saw that immediately. But we have to ask ourselves, as people who have been paying attention, are we perhaps taking another bigger framework as truth? Have we thought out all of what we know? Have we done that due diligence ourselves? And I think that's what Alan wanted us to do by encouraging us to read this book, Tragedy and Hope. And while I've been reading it, it dawned on me that this book is being written for a certain audience that gets sent out around the earth to act upon foreign policy of a central sort of controlling axis to federalize the world, really.
Yes.
And for those people to have that mission in their mind, it has to be truth for them. And perhaps they also go to extra sort of religious sort of ceremonies and things that we aren't privy to. But what I gather from reading this book so far is that he's creating a frame. He's creating a point of reference and a framework for a certain group of people. So within that framework, there's a lot of truth, but it's operating within a fictitious framework of reference. It's guiding a certain person in a certain direction for a certain task. But as you've pointed out, you've noticed already that you can't just split the human race into two different types of spiritual outlook. It's not normal for the average human being to have the Russian Orthodox outlook and for the Westerner to have a natural inherited genetic viewpoint. Those things are created in the minds of men by other men. So I think to myself, if I went to Russia right now, why would I expect somebody to, would I expect the first Russian person that I meet to live up to everything that Carol Quigley has described? of a Russian. I mean, they're human beings. Mm-hmm. There's an aspect towards the spiritual and the material with every human being. So I, in my own mind, I see Carol Quigley as creating frameworks or zeitgeists within a group of people that he is a professor of teaching for another group to go into the world and put their goals into action. The thing is, if you have conviction and you have a training, it's much easier for you to do something that goes against your conscience because you truly believe it. So I think that's why Carol Quigley goes to such great lengths and through such repetition to put a certain point of view across into the minds of the target audience for this book, because these people couldn't go around doing what they're doing if they were whole, if they had a whole view in their mind, if they were well rounded. So my message really is, keep all of this in mind when you go through this book.
I think that's a very good point too. And so what we're talking about here is that the circles within circles. And so Quigley was writing for the managerial class who continues to this day to be the managerial class. And it is a certain mindset. And they are not privileged to be in that circle who might need to know about ancient brotherhoods and priesthoods and what they thought about astrology and what they knew about precessions and ages and so forth. Yes. And also because even the way that Alan characterized that, you know, history is an intentional form of misinformation. It is intentionally creating a certain view of the world. And all of the people that Quigley was writing for, his true students, were participating in what we would now call the Cold War dynamic, but what still carries on because Russia is part of this axis with China, but it's essentially Russia. Russia is, if you look at Iran, if you look at what's going on in the Middle East, you follow it far enough, whoever the talking head is, and they will have been the type who would have gone to Georgetown, the type who is a diplomat or a general in the army that got this kind of, what it is indoctrination. This is how we see our civilization and our role in the world. And so really what Quigley is doing is, you got it right when you said he was an Anglophile, but what he's really doing is venerating Western civilization and touting all of its amazing wonders while at the same time painting the Orthodox civilization with this brush of nihilism, the Slav mentality who was in otherworldly, naturalistic, didn't even have the capacity to develop kinds of civilization that have come out of the West.
Melissa, can I make two anecdotes? I was going to leave it to the end of Russia, but we can do it in the beginning as well. It's something I just wanted to put across, because in my life I have met a few people that are operating restaurants and things in South Africa on my travels. Mm-hmm. I've met one woman who is a Romanian. I've met a man who has a very good restaurant in another town in South Africa. He is from Hungary. And when I was very young, I remember my parents were considering selling our house, and a Polish couple came around to take a look. And this was in sort of 1988, 1987. And I know that Poland and Hungary both, communism came to an end in 1989. And the Polish couple that I remember something that really stuck with me, and I think my parents remember too. He didn't have a lot to say, the father, but he was very well qualified. I think he was an ophthalmologist, I think. And the family, you could see that communism traumatizes people very, very deeply. They've got this etched look of strain in their eye, like they've gone through war. And I was too young to ask them any questions, but I just remember that very basic fact. And then on one of my business visits, I went to this restaurant, and the owner was quite chatty, you know. And I said, "Oh, you're from Hungary?" And you know, you spoke a little bit about politics, and South Africa always has something to talk about. And we couldn't help bring up what we are seeing happening in Europe, Western Europe and America. And he was saying, you know, the people better watch out. Communism is coming your way. And I've done some reading in my past, and something that I remember bringing up with him, and I want you to see how true it was, that during the communist era, the people that were not communists, as communism was coming in, it's a certain type of person. It's a political type of a politician, you know, the true psychopathic type. They will switch across to communism as easily as you and I will pick up a book to read. So a lot of leading sort of families in Hungary adapted very, very quickly to communism, persecuting other people, applying its principles, etc. But here's the point that's hard to swallow, is that when communism was lifted in the late 80s, I said to this guy, I said, well, what I've understood and what I've looked at is that all these leading communists, these certain families and things that were high up, they switched across to capitalism as easily as they switched across to communism. And I bet you that they're all still enjoying political power. And a guy said, yes. He says, it's absolutely absurd. There's no punishment for these people. These people are true chameleons. And they will switch across to the virtues of capitalism as quickly as they were and as deeply as they were in implementing communism in those countries. And it makes me think of that, the new president of Argentina,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't believe a word he says.
Mm-mm.
You know, he's part of the world group. It also takes me to that quote by Carol Quigley where I think you know it better than I do, but he basically said that people confuse us with communism,
mm-hmm.
Because we are so similar in our methods. And then I immediately think of the history of what I've seen with Putin. And when you look at how these so-called communists and heads of state of Russia blend and mix so easily with heads of state of Europe, and you know, I've got a few pictures of Kissinger and all the various heads of state that he's met. When he meets up with Putin on a few occasions, you would think that Putin is a little kid who's being visited by Santa Claus. Very, very excited to see Mr. Kissinger, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This group, this international group, this that heads all of these global institutions, this is the thing to keep in mind. They are, in a sense, very similar to communism, because they want to standardize and collectivize the people of the earth like resources to run efficiently. So don't think it's communism and that Putin is the bad guy trying to take over the United States. There's actually a higher layer of control and government that is managing both communism and capitalism below itself. And I think that'll take a lot of the confusion away from people when they watch TV, thinking that there's lots of talk that Putin is in opposition to the World Economic Forum.
Mm.
and that he's in opposition to the he's blocking progress towards a one world government. And that's just theater, because mm-hmm. when you take a closer look at Putin's activities behind the scenes in the Eastern Bloc, I can't remember what it's called, but what is the podcast that you go on with Johnny?
Dynamic Independence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember they brought it up. I think it was 1 or 2 years ago, but Putin was having the equivalent of the Russian. What do they? Damn it! I wish I had Johnny now to tell me what it was. I forget the wording for it, but it was a World Economic Forum conference in the grand scheme of the West. Exactly the same talking points, the whole bang shoot with regards to international free trade and the whole lot. But it was Russia that was hosting their version of it. So the global pattern, the globalists pattern, the technocrats pattern for a globally standardized system is being implemented in the East under Putin just as much as it's being done under Klaus Schwab or whoever else. You know, this East-West schism is just there for our – it's there to keep us afraid of the guy over there. So bottom line is we're all being played at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's interesting to me is the way that Putin has been what we get in the West is just pure propaganda. But one of the stories that I've seen recurring over the years is how Putin's big advisor is the head of the Russian Orthodox Church of Moscow, and this is the person who tells him what to do and what's the next move. And then you'll also see stories where, you know, Putin is basically being told what to do by, you know, Russian member, you know, the Sanhedrin, more or less, you know. In other words, there's the Jewish contingency within Russia that he answers to. So what you have is Putin is the big puppet who takes the tomatoes. It's so easy to say, oh, well, he has this many mansions and he's worth this much and he's the money that he has, he got, it's ill-gotten gain. And then, you know, we have so much of the characterization of we're fighting for resources. Go ahead.
It just reminds me of, on one of our other Telegram groups, I know a very insightful, a man from the Netherlands, and he raised a point because he had recently been to China, and the Chinese are indoctrinated in a collective sense, and they're very, very, very proud of that collectivism that they have in their society. It gives them strength, and they think it's quite foolish. They think the West's point of view of individualism is a bit silly. They think it's very weak and foolish, and they take great pride in being part of an homogenous whole. When I see the East and the West, all I see is a global dialectic at play. We in the West see Russia and China in a certain way, and it makes us think, you know, what human being could be comfortable with that? But it's a mirror image. It's mirrored to its opposite. You know, if you are growing up in Russia or China, you are looking at the West in a similar vein.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that with all this, the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've seen armies modernize and building up stockpiles of hardware. And what we do know from other works that Alan has referred us to is that there's going to be a blending of the East and the West, and it's not just spiritual. We know that they want to standardize the globe,
mm-hmm.
and that is with regards to economics primarily. And what follows from economics, the way that you do business, is the way that you interact with other people. So it's a global social order, a global economic order. But how do you how do you get that into place without people really noticing? Well, as soon as they do start to smell a rat, you have to bring in diversion. And the best way to get everyone all off balance is to bring in war, threats of war, strike up a few conflicts. And I'm just thinking that, you know, a whole series of wars which could be broadcast in apocalyptic type levels, but meanwhile they're not really that bad. But if you do it well, you can achieve that merging and that acceleration of geopolitical goals. You can disguise that intention through war. So possibly, as a lot of the Americans have been saying now, they envision a long drawn out war in the Ukraine now. It's not going to go away anytime soon. So that could be the perfect excuse. As Jacques Attali brought out, the Third World War would start in the Ukraine. That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So the Third World War could just be another accelerant in the same vein as the First World War and the Second World War had on creating a unified trading bloc in the European Union. So, an outbreak of a conflict involving many countries, call it a world war, would have the effect of accelerating the unification of a Middle Eastern trading bloc. It could create dividing lines between areas that they want to create, such as the Asia-Pacific Rim. And what I would like to encourage people to do, I know it's a big ask, but if people wanted to understand what happens after or where Carol Quigley leaves off with Tragedy and Hope, read a book by Jacques Attali. It's called The Brief History of the Future.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it fascinating because he uses the same type of idea that Carol Quigley brings up with the core of a civilization is such and such country.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has a semi-peripheral effect the further that you move away from the core, and then a periphery on the outer edges where that original core flourishes towards the end. Except when Jacques Attali talks about the core and the periphery, he's actually talking about it from a corporate business perspective. So what we do know is that they want to bring an end to the nation state. And they are going to create gradually through public-private partnership, the corporate entity is going to compete for the population's time with the state to a point where the state will become secondary and become just another little factor, tiny factor. It's going to be a world dominated by corporations who will have a very similar effect upon the earth in the same way as a nation state or an empire is enjoying today. I found it fascinating. And Attali's work seems to maybe contraindicate or contradict a little bit of Quigley's work. Or maybe it doesn't. But Attali talks about technocracy. He talks about how we're not going to go into another dark age. We're actually going to go into what he calls hyper capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like you're going to have a huge portion of the earth sort of unemployed, dominated over by huge, massive city-state corporations competing with one another. And these corporations themselves would have influence around the world. They would actually sometimes migrate to different parts of the world themselves. And opposed to what we think of as the World Economic Forum wanting to hedge us into little 15 or 20 minute cities. According to Attali, the workforce of the future is going to be nomadic. Mankind will be highly nomadic, following these corporations around the globe as they migrate.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this talk of locking people down is a temporary measure. And that's another thing that we can talk about sometime, because the Club of Rome mentioned that they want to implement something called degrowth. So I suppose before Attali's scheme comes into play, there's going to be a cutting back of the world population, and they're going to manage the economy in a degrowth phase where they can still push profits while the population shrinks. But I just found it very interesting, because it was in the back of my mind that Attali, he follows the same idea of a core, a periphery, you know, but instead of countries, it's corporations. So if you've got the time, if you really can, I would maybe do a little bit of that reading of that book.
Yes, I don't think it's actually such a big ask. I haven't read it in a few years, but unlike Quigley, Attali's book is something that you read in a week. It's very fast reading. Yeah, it's very fast reading, even though he does break down civilizations and these cores of financial activity that move. It's incredibly quick reading. Very interesting. It is a good companion to Tragedy and Hope, but it's not it's not that big of an ask.
You know, when Carol Quigley left off at the end of the, the one section, I forget, but he put a little question mark, what happens between Russia or the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Which one, will the United States be able to reach an age of expansion again? But Jacques Attali has an answer there. And I actually saw an interview that my wife had put up. I think she might have even maybe put it up on the book club. I'll have to check. But there are various interviews with Henry Kissinger. And they were asking Henry Kissinger in one interview about what the future lies in Russia. And Kissinger actually brought up something that Attali mentioned. And they are both in agreement about, well, this is where it could be going. China will expand westward and north. They will burst at the seams, and they will push into the east of Russia, and they will sort of cause an effect where Russians and Ukrainians and those of the Eastern European countries they'll put pressure on Europe, and they'll move into Europe. So on a geographical, geopolitical, if you look at the map, Europe will get bigger and Russia will shrink. And then China will grow out sort of north and west. So other articles that I've seen, and I've been curious about what Quigley said, because he said that in the 1800s, it was commonly accepted that Russia was a part of Europe. A bit of a backward part of Europe, according to Quigley, but nevertheless, they were viewed as being European, until they weren't, until they were seen as being too different. But if you look at the way that the Russian, before the Industrial Revolution, if you look at the history books and the artworks, you know, Russia and France and Germany didn't look too different. They looked very much the same in much, you know. So according to Macron, for example, I can try and link that article to the book club group, but quite a few times Macron in particular, who is a prodigy, he's a prodigy of Attali, has stated that he views Russia's role as being a central part of Europe. That comes out in a few other people's statements as well. So I'm not a gambling man and I don't profess to know the future, but if you listen to the guys that plan the future, this is what they've said. So if you imagine a huge influx of Russians and Eastern Europeans squeezing into Europe, and then China pushing out into where the Eastern Russia used to be, so that'll form a larger Asian, what they call it, an Asian Pacific Rim, and then Russia and Europe will become one, will become sort of like a Euro-Russian bloc, trading bloc. And if memory serves me right, I think that Britain won't be a part of that European group. It will align itself, as far as I can remember, with the US, with an amalgamated North and South America. So I think when it comes to all of these wars playing out in the present, maybe when you're watching them play out, think about what these characters have stated about the future as they see it, and see if you can't maybe predict how they are going to play these dialectical games to bring that about. And my personal little favorite to speculate on is that both Russia and Europe will eventually come to see that America is the big bad bully who's making life harder for both of them, you know? Mm-hmm. And the Americans might be seen as the bad boys that instigate unrest and war, and both Russia and Europe eventually come to their senses and realize that they're stronger together, and they'll boot the naughty Americans out. And that's my personal little, what do you call it, a hypothesis for now.
Well, you just made me think about words and language there when you were talking about the corporation and quickly writing about the corporation and its role in the future, and also Atali's similarity in his book about writing about cores of civilization and cores of financial and geopolitical activity. And the word core, C-O-R-E, is like a civilization core, and corp, C-O-R-P, they come from the same root word. And this is, this is Latin. This is corpus. This is the body. So in a way, we're talking about an oligarchic Borg, because we know that they abhor competition. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, at the top, at the very top, at the place that is only hinted at by Quigley in Tragedy and Hope, although having access to the Royal Institute of International Affairs and Council on Foreign Relations archives, he knows, and he writes about the Anglo-American establishment. So he understands that we are looking at one corporate body. He couldn't have even posited something like that in the 1960s if he didn't have access to that. So I do think we're looking at... Go ahead.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to raise about this so-called, I call it a East versus West dialectic being played out by a larger international federal group. But another way of trying to show people that there's no real true East versus West antagonism except at the bottom levels. If you think of BRICS, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and then I think they've added... I think Ethiopia, Somalia is in now.
I'm not sure about Somalia, but Ethiopia just joined recently. Egypt is in there, possibly Eritrea.
I heard Pakistan was one that was originally, that was a while ago, but they never went for it.
And well, I think there's such bad blood between India and Pakistan that it's...
Oh, yes. But here's the thing. If you take a look at where India is a massive player and a massive player to come. They are aligned with the Americans, with the Anglo-Americans.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, here you have Russia, which is the big bad bear, which is America's, its natural enemy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
A bit like how Britain and France were each other's, what do they call it again, the age-old enemy?
Nemesis. Or, I don't know.
So here you have BRICS and these countries, you know, you have China and Russia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now the Indians and the Chinese hate each other. They hate each other. South Africa is sort of like a weird anomaly because South Africa has friends everywhere. It has friends and enemies. It's friends with another's enemy. So they kind of sit on the fence. As far as I know, Brazil is all about being in bed with the United States. So here you have an economic union, or I don't quite understand BRICS properly, but it's an association of economies. And trade, I imagine. So here you have complete opposites on the grand global East versus West picture, but at the same time, they've made formal economic ties and are trading independently of America and its sort of allies. And yet America is allied to India. So it's all a big mismatch. There's no true East versus West dialectic going on with BRICS.
Mm-mm.
It's just a convenient set of economics. I take that quite seriously that, you know, Russia and the United States are not, you know, at the higher levels, they are business partners. They're not enemies. In the slightest. And if you take a look at what all the big businesses in India and China, they're all either American, British, old, legacy British companies, or German, French. They're just operating under Indian and Chinese labels. So from a business point of view and an economic arrangement point of view, there is no Cold War 2.0 or any particular schism of any note. It's just what we see on the news. Because
yes.
within each of those countries, there are the normal people who still believe that they are sovereign, that they still believe that India is glorious India, and India will always be for the Indians, etc., etc. So their viewpoint will be slowly brought into alignment with an international structure in time, that, and they'll probably bring up some kind of a conflict to bring about a union in those areas too, like they did in Europe. So I don't get worried at all about, I don't worry much about there being a World War III in the sense that the whole of mankind is going to be wiped out. I think if there is a World War III, it's going to be very strategic, and most of World War III will be televised with great drama and with great exaggeration, if there is one. So no, I don't live in fear of any of that kind of thing. I think that's also part of the framework of that great big lie that gives you a placeholder in your brain that you can now, everything else that you think about operates within that framework. And why should it? Why should you operate within a second-hand framework? It's time to really think about these frameworks that we hold, about what is normal and what is real. Let us say some of those frameworks are real. Well, why do you have to hold it for yourself? Why can't you have your own particular framework that's even greater than that, that sees past even that, those that you are given, even if they're correct? And once again, it boils back down to, that's why it's important to read these books. Okay, Alan himself said, you know, don't take my word for it. Take a look. And when you start doing the exercise, particularly being on a book club such as you and I, and then trying to relate this information back to other people, I'm reminded of these thoughts that I've had myself in an earlier time, and it's just more vivid to me now. It reminds me to also watch out that I don't fall into some kind of placeholder. that's been carefully crafted for me to operate within.
So you've made me think of something that I just added to the introduction of the Redux that I just finished doing before we started this recording. And that was a little interview with Times Radio out of the UK, talking to a retired American general by the name of Ben Hodges, who was the head of the United States Army in Europe, and he's still a consultant with NATO. And what he was saying to this woman that he was talking with at Times Radio was that America, the strikes that they just did on Iraq and Syria, indirectly aimed at Iran, he said, we need to get in there with Iran, because if we can take care of Iran, we take care of Putin. And
oh, yes, of course. They want to bring him in.
Yeah. And so, and this is whether he has the education to see the hidden hand behind it or not, I don't know. But for his position, where he is in the East versus West thinking, this is what he's saying. Okay, go after Iran, because that takes care of Putin. That gets Putin out of the way. And this is why it's so very important to be able to remove yourself from that kind of thinking, because at the top, above everything, like you've just said, there's not a division. It is a body that really does have the same plan, however they present it and however different it looks, because it is necessary, and Alan pointed this out very often, it is necessary for the little man or woman at ground level to have that view of nationalism whenever it is needed, because what will people fight for if they feel that their own, I mean, look at what's happening here in the southern border of the United States and what is happening in many places in Europe and Ireland where people feel that they're being invaded. That makes them draw in on themselves like a turtle tucking into its shell. This is my nation. I want it to be safe. I want it to be exclusive to me and my kind. But at the same time, you talk about this movement towards Baha'i or a one world kind of religion. And so simultaneous to us being used for nationalism is moving us towards the new religion for the new age that is here and unfolding around us. And the one last thing to tie the being used for nationalism while we're being moved into a uniform system.
Yes.
Is the idea that Westerners have that is supported by somebody like Carol Quigley when he talks about individualism and laissez-faire capitalism and so forth. The elevation of the individual, which, my goodness, I believe in the individual, for sure. But you have to step back. You have to look at, you know, people who have covered their bodies with tattoos have done this, and I'm not picking on people that have a tattoo. I'm not picking on you that are tattooed, but what I'm saying is that it is very easy to move people collectively into adapting behaviors, body art, apparel, music, and so forth. It is very easy to move a Westerner who supposedly has this individualistic background into a collective way of behaving. What were you going to say?
I just wanted to reinforce what you were saying about if we ask ourselves, what is the default? What is the natural man? What is the natural man? They will talk to people like in China and Russia. It's all about the virtue of working together as one.
Mm-hmm.
In the West, it's about liberal individualism, the freedom to express yourself as an individual. And no man or woman is either one or the other. You're supposed to be a healthy blend of the two, because there is you, the individual, but there's also you, the individual, who has to live with and interact with other unique individuals with their preferences. And so as your parents teach you when you're a little baby, as a little baby, you are a pure little narcissistic psychopath sometimes. In the, you know how little children are, they want everything their own way. They don't want to share a thing. And you learn that, you know, somebody else's liberty stops before your fist hits their face, or kind of thing. You learn to cooperate. So human beings are individuals, but they are also groups. And if anyone is trying to lead you off into one particular view, you can laugh them out of the room. They are simply unbalanced people. It's either direction. And these people that push these ideologies, they can fall into two camps of being true believers themselves and misled, or they are knowingly doing it to influence you so that you do their bidding without knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
And these ideologies are very similar to how organized religion messes with people. Because you can have, you can take Christianity and you can make it suit your individual outlook, but you can also make it suit your collectivist outlook too. And if you haven't taken the time of day to get to first principles and then how to spot contradictions and how to detect error, you know, somebody else can occupy your mind and substitute themselves within you, and you will just become a parrot, a repeater of somebody else's thoughts. And they could say, well, you know, no good individualist or no good collectivist would do such and such, and therefore now they're shaping your future behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be, what did Alan say? He said you have to be the own, the guardian of your own mind.
Right.
It just boils down to you. If you picture the mind as a, you know that famous statue where you have the rider sitting on a horse holding the reins?
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about being in control of oneself. The horse is your wild sort of instinct, your vices, your lusts, your body's wants and needs.
Well, you know? some idea of that is that you're talking about, yeah, left and right brain, you know, right, left and,
yes,
right hemisphere. But
yeah. Yeah.
You do have to be in the driver, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that if somebody wants to really take control of their life and to not be dragged across from one point of view, from one TV program or YouTube interview to the next, and you keep moving across from one view to the other, you've got to do soul searching.
Mm-hmm.
And I would actually recommend reading, but reading in the same way that a detective does forensics, you know, and actually form your own your own opinion of what you're looking at. Don't just, because reading can also have the opposite effect if you don't do it right. And that's the benefit of going through this book, of Carol Quigley's. It's giving us, even if we even if someone who is listening to us speaking and still is completely in disagreement with us, if they just spend the time reading the book themselves, they've improved themselves in some degree, and hopefully it might just help them to overcome bias of their own.
I think, too, we'll probably wind this down, but just in terms of thinking about the dialectic and overcoming biases and so forth, I'll make a movie recommendation. Alan and I watched a movie that I believe came out in 2006. I looked it up a while ago, but it is a Russian film called, the English title is The Island. And it's
The Island.
It's Russian, and it is a fictional piece, but it is quite well done. It's visually lovely to look at. But this is a monastery. These are Russian Orthodox monks. And I won't give too much away. It's been years since I saw it, but I believe that the main character is some kind of convict or escaped convict, or maybe he was sent to the island as part of his punishment. But anyway, he is a criminal who is living amongst monks, and he comes to be seen by the group of Russian Orthodox monks there as a kind of seer. And what the movie will give you is a glimpse into a Russian mindset around spirituality. And there's a lot of humor. It's subtitled, it's kind of slow moving, it may not be for everyone. But there's a great deal of humor there, particularly regarding spiritual hypocrisy. The tricks that we play with ourselves when we think, and again, this gets into Quigley is writing about the extremes of the Russian mindset, but he himself in his depiction thus has fallen into extremism by only seeing such extreme differences in the two cultures.
Melissa, can I butt in quickly? Mm-hmm. What you're saying is that, sorry, not what you're saying, but I just wanted to say that when I was reading the book on Russia and imagining myself to be an American, from what I know of Americans and what America stands for, freedom, etc., if I was a true blue American reading Carol Quigley's works and saying, aha, yes, those damn Russians, blah, 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 all Russians are like that, if I was nodding along with Carol Quigley, reading this book, I wouldn't be thinking. And as you say, you could be tricking yourself, because if you were sound and had a whole mind, you would think to yourself, you know, this person is dragging me along on a little trip here, you know, and I am to view Russian people as almost the wrong type of human being.
Yeah.
Which, if you've had any experience of meeting people from around the world, you'll notice that people are more like you than you realize.
Yeah, I think it's easy enough. I haven't tried to see if the film is available for viewing. It might be up free here and there, but The Island, I think it's a good little homework assignment for this section of the book, because it really does give you I what I'm assuming is a glimpse into the mind of at least the Russian writer and director, but there's some humor there in what you might call that extremist. It's almost insightful, like a little poking fun at themselves. But I think it's a good for the Western mind to see that, like, just like you said, we are not that different. And the hypocrisy that can be, that can come out of thinking that we are so different and thinking that we are superior is, it's a slippery slope.
Melissa, I think that the conversation that we've had tonight is far more interesting than what I had lined up in my notes.
I didn't touch on my notes that much either.
I think, you know, what's nice about the book club is that everyone else has read along and they've read the same material. So they can kind of understand our conversation and perhaps agree or disagree, but they've read the material. So the material that we have read has prompted us to have this discussion. And I think that's the important part, because the next person that joins you for a discussion will also have their particular language that they use. And it's very, very interesting to hear how other people view the same material that you've just taken a look at. And while I'm with you still, Melissa, because we mentioned this before, I've stated earlier to you, Melissa, that I am going to be very busy this month. I'm moving house and all kinds of things where I just, although I could probably read the Buffer Fringe, I'm just not going to be way too busy to be able to be ready enough with, you know, to break it down to anybody else in a meaningful way. So there have been a number of people on the book club. I think, is it David?
David and has David and Adam have both both expressed an interest in joining in. And I'll tell you, I have just announced this on the Redux that went up, that I too am taking about 2 or 3 weeks off to do this personal, basically moving into the house task. But what we're springing this on David and Adam, but they both volunteered already. So, but we're springing this on them, that we may let them take the lead in the Buffer Fringe conversation. You don't think that you're going to join in at all, and I may or may not, but if I do, I'm still going to let them take the lead on the conversation, because I will have read the material, but I don't know how much time I will have been able to give it any extra thinking.
I think if I'd had to appear on as a on the book club and giving my point of view, I think I'd be so stressed, I'd sweat so hard, I think I'd end up just being a pool of water on the floor.
Well, this is good. So, in this way, it lets it be a real book club, because, you know, this next segment, you and I may be decked out all together, or it may just be me, but barely participating. But, you know, Adam and David have expressed an interest in talking, so we're going to let them take the lead on the Buffer Fringe. Now, that before we wrap up, I'll also say that's the next reading assignment for all of February. But you and I have talked about doing one more shorter conversation than today, but just to do a few thoughts on the section there in the beginning where Quigley talks about the different types of capitalism, banking, and what is money. And if you're still interested in doing that, then you and I can record that in a day or two.
That's a nice little one. It's it sets the tone for probably the rest of the book. Because it's all about economy, business, corporates. It's all about the different ages of controlling people through politics and money. And then we can have what we could talk about in that conversation is what money is going to become.
Okay.
Because money, as we know it, is about to change radically.
Well, let's wrap this one for today, and then we'll plan on when we're going to do the money. And then Adam, I'll try to give an email heads up to Adam and David that they are taking the mic for the Buffer Fringe, so they won't be caught, you know, taken by surprise when they hear this recording.
Adam, I know that you can do it, and David, you've made so many comments. I'm absolutely sure that you're going to be able to do it as well. So you're in.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening and participating in this. I was very pleased to see how many people subscribed to Telegram, how many people have listened to the audio or watched the little video just because of what's going on. I said this at the beginning, but I really mean it this time because of my personal projects that I'm trying to get done. I think I'm going to slap a picture or two or three onto this talk and the next one that Darren and I have on banking, and that's that, because it's too time consuming to make a whole video, and I really do need to focus on, you know, in a way Darren and I are doing the same thing, which is settling into a new environment, and we've got to do that.
It's starting to feel a bit more comfortable already.
Good. All right. Well, listen, everybody who's listening, thank you. And I will post this as soon as possible, which is probably going to be Monday or Tuesday. Darren and I will be talking again soon. That'll probably go up on Thursday or Friday of the week. And that's us signing out for this episode. Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers, folks.